Hello, you're listening to Buddhist Studies Footnotes. I'm Cody Muncaster from the Little Heron Zen tradition. I wrote the book Queer Engaged Buddhism. I've taught at the Buddhism Psychology and Mental Health program at U of T, and I'm also a trauma therapist. And I'll be hosting a mini series within this podcast where I'll be interviewing queer folks within Buddhism and people who talk about queerness in Buddhist studies as well. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with Ryan Becker, aka Twinkle, of Queer Sangha. So, Queer Sangha is a hybrid Montreal-based group for queer folks interested in Buddhism and meditation. They host in-person sessions as well as online sessions for people from around the world. I wanted to start by asking you a little bit about yourself and how you got involved in Buddhism and what your practice looks like.
Sure. I got involved in Buddhism through doing a 10-day Vipassana meditation, as taught by SN Goenka. But I got in, like, rewinding a little bit further, I was interested in meditation and going on that course because I was in recovery. So I got sober in 2012 as a part of, like, my program of recovery. It was encouraged to me that I meditate, and it was, I guess, a challenge at first. Like, those, I was one of those people who said all those things of, like, oh, I can't quiet my mind, I have a really hard time. But I did, I tried a bunch of times, and I did it, and I enjoyed it, and there was something helpful that I got from just, like, being quiet with my mind and realizing, the way that the mind is malleable, because for so many years I'd thought in a really particular way, and then when I stopped using substances, I was able to sort of change the obsessive thinking. And I didn't really necessarily associate that with meditation or Buddhism or anything like that. But when I kept hearing about the 10-day Vipassana courses, and then finally I met someone who could at least, like, give me enough information to for me to and encouragement for me to actually go on a course. So my first course was in the Blue Ridge Mountains in Virginia. It was, as usual, in the at least in those years, it was segregated, men and women. And I was less than a year on testosterone, and I was on the men's side. So it was the first time that I was ever really in an environment like that, because it wasn't at a center, it was at a summer camp. And so I was dorming with 10 men in one cabin. And that was quite the experience. But what I really remember about that time was hearing the teachings. Oh, I did, before going, I was like, I want to know what I'm getting myself into. I read the whole book of The Art of Living, I think it's called. And it's not written by Goenka, someone else wrote it, but it's a lot of his words and his teachings. So I kind of had a lot of those stories fresh in my mind, and a lot of the theory behind the practice. It made a ton of sense in my mind. But I'm one of those learners where I have to, like, get a bit of everything before I can really grasp it. And I'm also, at least getting sober, since getting sober, I'm very dedicated to learning. I try to be a really good student. So in this course, I really got to experience, what this book just talked about. I got to really sit through it, and it was very much like I went and saw for myself what this practice could provide, and it was incredible. It was life-changing. There were some really interesting experiences, some really profound experiences. The teacher was extremely helpful. It was one, usually there's, like, a men's teacher and a women's teacher. This course was quite small. It was only 50 of us, and there was one female teacher. So it was really nice to be able to connect with her, and she helped me through a bit of it. And then from there, I felt like my life had changed, especially as a trans person who, like growing up, I had like a kind of hatred at worst, or like ignoring at best of my body. And that practice, specifically like the Goenka technique of like using the scans, really helped me to feel at home in my body for the first time. It took, yeah, so that was back in 2015. And I've gone through a whole journey with it, with meaning like through, going to the Vipassana, the 10-day Vipassana courses, and being in that tradition, but then also kind of straddling with the, insight tradition, the more Western Vipassana tradition, and like the wacky politics around that, have been super interesting to me. But it's really, when it comes down to it, it's about the practice and my own practice. And for me, it looks like way more practicing with other people than on my own. I will, I did a 6-week meditation retreat this past fall, and that was pretty profound. I feel like I get a lot from my practice in the day-to-day, not necessarily when I'm on my cushion, but like out in the world, and I'm able to connect with my breath, connect with my body, connect with the teachings. Like the Dharma teachings have been so profound. Like the more and more I listen and learn, yeah, the more they just like help me navigate, like even just like the concept of the second arrow I've been reflecting on lately a lot. I don't know if that answers your question fully, but that's what comes to mind at least. I could just go on, and I don't want to do that because it's not just about me, it's about queer Sangha as well.
It does answer it, and the more that you're open to sharing, the more content that we have for our listeners. So by all means, and it sounds like the practice has been really impactful for your recovery. And I know you also mentioned that what it's like being a trans masculine person navigating the world, and I wonder what your journey has looked like as a queer trans person navigating Buddhism.
Yeah, I remember being on that first course. Well, first I should say the teacher called me and said, are you sure you're okay with dorming with men? And I'd heard, at some centers they give trans people their own room. So I remember saying like, well, there's, is there any chance that I could get my own room? And she was like, no, 'cause there wasn't, it was a summer camp that they rented out. So there was no question. I had to dorm with men, but I wanted the experience so badly that I was like, that's fine, I'll just do it. And it really, that experience taught me a lot about my gender. I remember looking over at the women's side, seeing the women, and being like, I'm glad I'm not over there, actually. Like, I felt at that time, at least, I felt more comfortable on the men's side. After that, I did another course, again at a rented spot. I didn't get my own room on the men's side again. I've never, that time I had a male teacher. I've never, those two experiences, I didn't have an issue. And then I went to serve a course, in Hereford in the UK. And that was the first time I'd ever actually been to a center, and it's a big center, and it's quite established. It's an older center. I forget when it was built, but it's been around for a long time. And I served the course there. That was really nice. And then I decided to go back, I think the next year. So this was in 2018. I was I think it was 2018, a long-term server for 2 months. there. And that was really interesting because I got to know the center better. I got to understand the politics a bit better. I'd always known why they separated, like the theory behind why they separated the men and the women. But I got to really see the behind the scenes more than I ever had. And I was totally open about being trans, about being non-binary. Although at that time I was less comfortable in my non-binary identity than I am now. But I was still able to explain, like, hey, like, I don't feel necessarily comfortable on either side. And I did a lot of advocacy there. And the whole time I was living there, I had my own room. I even, for a while, had my own trailer, which was cool, to have my own kind of like building on the property. And they were receptive to what I had to say and what I had to share. And that was, yeah, that was a pretty cool experience. And then when I moved to Montreal later that year, I didn't do another course for a long while. But I did a 3-day course at Montebello, at the Vipassana Center there. And at that time, I decided that I would sit on the women's side. I hadn't been taking testosterone for a number of years. My hair was long. I had facial hair, but I just shaved. And I went on the women's side because I'd never sat on the women's side. And like I said, I don't feel comfortable on either side. So when I did that, it wasn't that much different than being on the men's side as far as my practice goes or my experience goes. They did give me my own room, which I appreciated. And I did a bit of advocacy work after that and just explaining, like, I've only ever sat on the men's side in all the other courses that I've done. And the woman was just like trying to wrap her head around what I was talking about. And yeah, I think just like I'm one of those trans people who I'm like totally out and open for the most part with my identity because I have so many friends who aren't comfortable with that. And I know that like just by me being open about my experience and how it is for me, it will help people who aren't as comfortable being open. Like it'll help kind of. Sometimes I'm, you know, the first trans person that someone knowingly meets. Yeah, it's just a way for me to kind of like give back to the community because I don't, it doesn't really bother me. So then I ended up going back for the last time, I think the last time to that center in the Goenka tradition, and did a 10-day on the men's side. It was nice because I had a trans friend who was a trans masculine friend who was also there with me. So it was the two of us on the men's side. And then it just so happened that like at the end, when everyone can talk again, we met two non-binary people on the women's side. And just to give you an idea, if anyone listening doesn't sort of know what I'm talking about with how strict they are with segregation, after you know, silence was lifted, the noble silence was lifted, and we could all start talking again, and everyone was interacting at all centers, as far as I know. They're pretty strict about going back to segregation when we're eating. So these non-binary people who are on the women's side were over on the men's side hanging out with us, and they were just like, we're just gonna eat here, you know, whatever. So they started eating with us on the men's side, and sure enough, like one of the servers, like one of the people working, came up to them, and they were like, "Hey, like you need to be on the women's side. We have to ask you to go to the women's side." All of that being said, there are changes. I know of at least a few courses that happen every year. That are specifically for trans and non-binary people, and they don't do the same sort of segregation, which is helpful. I'm glad that exists. I'm really glad that exists. I left for other reasons. It wasn't necessarily because of my gender identity that I stopped being involved in that tradition. It was more about how strict they are with who you can and can't practice with outside of the centers. So I decided to leave, and one of the reasons why I decided to do the 6 week retreat this past fall is because I wanted to experience another tradition in a deeper way. Because the 2 months at that retreat at the Goenka Center really immersed me. And this 6 weeks at IMS, Insight Meditation Society in Barre, Massachusetts, that also sort of immersed me in a much more progressive, I would describe, atmosphere. Definitely more westernized, but a little bit more welcoming for like who I am and my identity. And yeah, just looking back, I don't think I had any issues in the entire 6 weeks about my gender identity, as far as I mean, I'm sure I went through some stuff on my own, but not necessarily with other people having an issue with it. I really do, yeah, I see it sort of like as a construct. And I think that entire time, like the 6 weeks, like if anything, like just made me like more confident in my gender identity and in how I choose to live the gender that I am.
And eventually, all of this led to Queer Sangha. So, what was the development of Queer Sangha? How did that come about?
Queer Sangha started in 2019, in the summer of 2019, when a friend of ours, because I helped to start it with my partner Coral, and then a friend Pierre Vincent and another friend Parni, and we all got together because we wanted to start a queer meditation group. And Coral had started a queer meditation group in Berlin a few years prior called Queer Meditation, but Parnit decided to call it Queer Sangha. So we went with that name. And we started to meet at Kuperg at Concordia. It was, it started off as kind of a small group. We had, I think we, I don't even know how we advertised. I think it was word of mouth, and maybe we had started our Instagram. I think we started our Instagram pretty early, so we were just trying to spread the word. We moved first to a different location, so we were meeting there for a while, and then when the pandemic hit, we went online. And then we stayed online for a long time. I am not remembering if we were hybrid before the pandemic. I don't think we were. But once we started meeting back in person, we stayed online because, our sort of membership, or at least the people who attended, had grown so much into different areas throughout throughout the pandemic. So we've always been Montreal based, but we, connected with so many different people, across the country, across North America and further. And also, we're able to sort of connect with so many people and so many different sanghas because Coral does a really great job of finding different guest teachers for the last Wednesday of every month. So that's really nice. And we're only online on the last Wednesday so that everyone can kind of like be in front of the computer with the guest teacher instead of having it hybrid. And then, yeah, when we're hybrid, like sometimes we'll have a teacher online, sometimes we'll have a teacher in person. And we really do try to be peer-led. So we try to get as many of the community members involved as possible, like people who receive the teachings, receive the skills that meditation brings, and they want to give it back, so they start providing teachings as well. Yeah, so it's we've tried to be consistent. We've tried to, show up every Wednesday, but after a while we decided to take breaks during the summer. So we usually take July and August off. But other than that, we're there every Wednesday. And it's really, yeah, it's just been a really beautiful experience to, meet people, to have a place for people to come to. A lot of people come from heartbreak. A lot of people come when there's, big changes in their lives. We get a lot of students who, when they have to take a class on Wednesday, they're super sad to miss it, but they're very happy to come back when the semester's over. We have a sweet group online, sweet group in person. It's sometimes hard to connect the two. I feel like sometimes people who just go in person don't know who's online, and the online people don't necessarily know who's in the room. But it's the same energy, the same curiosity and dedication to the practice and joy for sure.
And could you share a little bit about what you folks do in terms of the format and what a typical queer sangha session would look like?
Sure. Usually we will gather and we'll say the welcome message, which involves a land acknowledgement. And then after that, traditionally, I think before the pandemic, we would do something like sit, walk, sit, and then maybe a metta meditation, like a loving kindness meditation, and then discussion, probably. We stopped the walking when we were just online. I would like to bring that back. But our venue right now isn't necessarily big enough to have the amount of people that show up walking. But maybe in the park across the street. We do have, like, at least bare minimum, we try to have, the welcome message, some sort of practice, some sort of metta meditation, and some sort of discussion. And then we have community announcements at the end, which is always good for, getting the Sangha involved in sort of outside events, or to be able to share and promote different things. When we have teachers come, it's a little bit different. We let them do whatever they want to do. We say we try to encourage them to at least do some meditation. Yeah, the discussions are always really good. Sometimes, it's been where we do a little bit of practice and we focus, especially when there's big world events going on, or issues in the community. We'll try to, like, leave more time for the discussion instead of just having like 5 minutes at the end. We try to really draw it out and make that space for many voices to be heard and many ideas to be shared. We also do, right now, on the third Wednesday of every month, we do a 1 hour sit. We call it the Power Hour, and that's our nod to the Goenka tradition, where they do a straight hour. It is challenging for some, but I think it's also exciting to sort of triumph over this challenge. For a lot of people, we try to, if it is someone's first time meditating, we try to really give a lot of instruction. We say, if you want to get up, or if you want to write, or if you want to lay down, if you want to take a nap. Like, we really, and that's for anyone, not just the newcomers, it's for anyone who shows up. And people really like it. If we didn't have people showing up and we had people giving us feedback that they didn't like it, we would have probably stopped by now. But the fact that people keep showing up, and they, I've heard many times people showing up and saying, "I really need this. I really need this time." I get emotional just thinking about it. Like, I think there's something really powerful with being in a room, both physically and virtually, with other queer and trans people, and just being silent in our dignity, in our practice, in the Dharma, in the gifts, like really understanding the gifts of this practice, and understanding, like, the more you give to the practice, the more you get from it. There's, like, such a deep trust, I think, that comes with that. I think, just off the top of my head, like, really considering, like, what it might be like for a listener to be hearing this and being like, an hour? Why? I think there's something just about like us resting our nervous systems together. And yes, there is so much that needs to be said and needs to be discussed and needs to be known and learned and taught and all of that. But I think there's also so much that we can communicate and learn and feel and experience without words, without language. And yeah, I can f sometimes in those situations, especially like I said, when there's world events going on, when there's, which is always, when there's, personal struggles that I know are happening, people are in good moods when the weather's good, when the weather's bad, whatever is happening on those third Wednesdays, like this, the room, the people, the space can hold that. It can hold all of those, thousand joys and thousand sorrows, 10,000 joys and 10,000 sorrows. Those are pretty special queer sanghas. But then, every other week, at least the first and second, and then if there's 5 Wednesdays, the fourth Wednesday are all kind of freestyle as far as like what happens. Coral does a really, really, really good job of programming. It's a lot of work. I try to help. I fill in whenever they ask me to. But yeah, it is a joy to be with everyone every week and to go through all those different iterations of Queer Sangha.
Yeah, and speaking of the iterations of Queer Sangha, I know that you folks have had a variety of different guest teachers come on Zoom, and often those are recorded so people can go on YouTube and they can look up some of those talks. And so for anybody who's listening who might want to look up some of those talks, I wonder if you have in your memory any ones that were some of your really favorite ones or that you really learned a lot from, other than the one I did, of course, which I'm sure everybody loved. I'm kidding, I'm only joking. But yeah, if there were any that stood out to you that you would recommend that people look at, or any takeaways from those that you'd like to share with the listeners.
Yeah, no, it was great to have you, of course. It's always such a treat when we have like Sangha members show up to do that, to do the teaching, which is rare, you're rare that you were a member and then a teacher.
Oh, I was only kidding, but no, but I was glad to be there. But yeah, I'd love to hear about some of the talks that you enjoyed.
Yeah, I mean, there's been so many over the years, and I actually don't remember what was recorded and what wasn't because people can choose to opt in or opt out. I remember, I think she was the first guest teacher was Leslie Booker, and Leslie Booker, who goes by Booker, was definitely a hit, for sure. Like we really loved hearing from her and just like her knowledge and the way that she sort of presents the Dharma is just so lovely. Let's see, we've had Pascal Au Clair, which is so sweet because he's local. He's actually coming again this month, to end the season. I think there's something so deeply personal about how the Dharma is taught by each person that it ends up being that like you learn so much about like, are they really into the lists? Are they really into like their version of what this particular teaching means for this particular situation? I really appreciate, yeah, just like getting to know all the different types of Dharma that everyone creates from their, from their experience of being in, whatever lineage they're in.
When you are teaching, what's important to you in terms of your style?
Other than the retreats that I've done in the practice, my own practice, I'm untrained, so I don't necessarily feel like I'm qualified to like go too deep. So what I tend to do is I try to make the practice as accessible as possible. A lot of the times I do the 1 hour meditation. The one Dharma talk that I did do for sort of the last Wednesday of the month. I talked about time, the Dharma and time, because I nerd out on that topic. So that's why I chose that. I think it's helpful to relate the Dharma to like our own lives and in ways in like in that way of like connecting it to something that, you know, I'm interested in or I care about. But also like there's a way to use the Dharma to kind of problem solve, you know, the basic teaching of everything changes. It's always changing. Everything is change. That's really helpful. And then also like loving kindness is one of my favorite things to go into because it's, yeah, one of the things that I've practiced a lot in my own on my own. So then being able to share that with others has been really beautiful.
And with time too, I know in gender and sexuality studies, as a subset of queer theory, there's a wealth of literature. Well, wealth might be hyperbole. There's a growing body of literature on queer temporalities, which is like queer theory about time. And I remember when I was doing grad school, I was shocked that there was enough interest in something so niche as the queer philosophy of time that there could be an entire course that was offered on it.
Oh, I would have loved to have taken that.
I really felt when I came across that, I thought, wow, like everything really has already been done and thought of, that something so niche could already have come to fruition. In terms of how Queer Sangha is run and how it's been developed and how it continues, I'm curious as to what's important to you folks in terms of the values around Queer Sangha, in terms of is how it operates and the space that you folks have created, because it seems to me from the times that I've attended that it's created with a lot of intention and very carefully.
Yeah, that's a really good question. And thank you for noticing that. 'Cause I think you're right. I think we try to make it as welcoming of a space as possible. So that involves, you know, like speaking to new people when there's new faces, just like welcoming them, saying like, "Hey, is it your first time?" And being really welcoming to people who aren't necessarily familiar with Buddhism or meditation. So we don't always like dive deep into the Pali Canon every week, you know? We leave that to like the guest teachers at the end of the month and we try to really focus on like kind of the basics all the other weeks. And we'll, you know, a lot of the other teachers are really, really good at guiding and bringing people like through these really calming, grounding meditations, and the loving kindness meditations, you know, we try to make them as accessible as possible. I think it also involves like the leaders having our own practice, making sure that we don't overexert ourselves with other projects or, you know, with trying to be, you know, the best that we can be for for everyone. It's more about like just being right sized and being, you know, consistent with always showing up, always being there, never canceling, and just being, you know, knowing that we don't have to be perfect, but at least like that we can show up and be there for whoever decides, whenever they decide to show up, to just be there to welcome them. We also have tea. Tea is very important. So now we have, at this point, we have two tea carafes that we make. Sometimes we make different types of tea. Sometimes it's the same tea in both. And, you know, we have people on tea duty who pour the tea and bring it around to people, which is always really sweet. It's always herbal tea.
Love tea.
Some of us, yeah, some of us eat dinner beforehand, so we go out to Thali beforehand, which is really nice. And then afterwards, you know, if people have the energy, we sit around and talk or stand and talk, go outside and talk, depending on what the weather's like. And I think there's like this level of, I don't know, friendliness, I guess you could say, that we try to cultivate like among ourselves, among the members. We try to also, be sources of mutual aid where we can be. We discourage leaders from having any kind of romantic relationship with the people who attend, which is really important because we realize, even though it is peer led, that the people who are in leadership positions do have a certain amount of power that we wouldn't want to be used for causing harm. Yeah, I mean, we, speaking of causing harm, like the precepts are important to us. We usually do them every New Year's, so we do a New Year's sit, and so we go over the precepts and we pay homage to the triple gems, and we do some kind of ritual around that, usually with the red yarn symbolizing the monk's robes that we put around our wrists. But yeah, we try to just be welcoming to all and to understand that the well-being of the group is really important, and that we as individuals benefit from the group being as strong as it can be. And sometimes that's, that means that as leaders, we need to sacrifice certain things in order to be able to show up or to lead or hold the space in the ways that we want.
I've taught a course at U of T called Socially Engaged Buddhism, and I've noticed that from my experiences at Queer Sangha, which were a long time ago, but it seems like there's a strong importance placed on things like accessibility, on anti-racism, on decolonial practice. And I wonder if you might be able to speak to how that's practiced in the space, and what you folks do to ensure that it's a welcoming space for all.
Yeah, this is a great question. And I think you're right. I mean, I think we are a welcoming space. I think it involves a lot of education. It involves, and which has involved a lot of discomfort. Coral and I have done, I think at this point, like maybe three different sort of short courses on anti-racism, teaching them. We've done a lot more on our own as students, but we've taught three based in Buddhism and engaged Buddhism, and so that's been pretty powerful to like look at history is so important. So looking at the history involved in, the making of the current systems and under which we're living in. And then also, to understand the lineages that Buddhism comes from, and how it is rooted in so many Asian cultures, which have been erased and ignored by so many other more westernized meditation groups who kind of like whitewash the whole thing. So we try to avoid that as much as possible. We try to, we always bring it back to Gautama the Buddha. We talk about, the length of time, the 2600 years that these teachings have been practiced and spread. We understand, that everyone joining us has had different experiences in their lives, and they face different oppressions, and we understand intersectionality. Like, apart, even just like aside from Queer Sangha, like, we're always trying to educate ourselves as much as possible about like the world and what it means to be like people with a relative amount of privilege navigating. And we're always learning. I mean, a big topic that consistently comes up, usually before Queer Sangha, is what are we reading? Like, what are the books that we're reading? And a lot of us, a lot of us read really interesting, helpful, diverse authors. Yeah, so I feel like we're constantly like just trying to keep up with understanding, what's happening in the world and how to be engaged Buddhists.
And it reminds me of one of the first activities that I do when I teach socially engaged Buddhism at the university is I ask them names of famous Buddhists that they've heard of. So often, like for example, people who they've read books on or who they've seen on TV, and then I write the names on the board, and I ask like, what do these people have in common? And often, a lot of the students have read almost exclusively from white authors, or the people that they've heard of are people who are maybe not white but are very famous in the West, because of a strong influence in the West. Like maybe a lot of people have heard of Thich Nhat Hanh, but they won't have heard of any other Vietnamese Buddhist masters, because of the strong influence that Thich Nhat Hanh had in the West. And I also ask, are there any other commonalities? And sometimes people will see it. Sometimes people won't realize at first that most of the authors that people will list tend to be men, except for Pema Chodron. And then, of course, I rarely ever have people suggest the name of somebody who's queer. I don't know if I can recall any time where somebody has mentioned the name of a queer Buddhist person that they've heard of when I've done that exercise. So it really goes to show how our knowledge, our understanding of the practice is really constructed by people who are given certain forms of social privilege as well. So I was just reminded of that when you had mentioned that luckily you folks read from diverse books, which I think is really valuable. And so I just had one last question. So for people listening, I'm curious as to what, if you have different practical recommendations as to what other sanghas could do that might replicate what Queer Sangha does in terms of supporting queer and trans and intersex folks in terms of creating spaces that are anti-racist and that are accessible.
This is a great question and something, yeah, that I'm really honored to share. Okay, one thing that I didn't mention that I probably should have mentioned was with the format, we always have an introduction round. Not always, but usually. We usually do the welcome message and then the intro round. So the intro round is an opportunity for all voices to be heard. We share our pronouns during the intro round. So I think any opportunity to have all the voices be heard in the room, have, sharing pronouns be normalized. And if there's someone making a joke about pronouns, like maybe like a cis person being like, wow, I don't care, like maybe explaining to them why it's important to not necessarily joke about it and just say, just say your pronouns. Move on. And we do a question of the day, which is sometimes silly. Like, if you were a type of pasta, what, I don't know if we've ever done that. But like, if you're a type of plant, or if you're, I think we did one time, we were like, if you were a sea creature, what sea creature would you be? So just like cute questions to help people feel like sort of like an icebreaker to welcome them.
Maybe that's like a queer thing, because it seems like every queer group I've been to, it's like name, pronoun, and wild question of the day.
Yeah, that's so queer. Straight people are missing out. Yeah, I think not being afraid of challenging topics. So, for instance, like back in 2020, when George Floyd was m brutally murdered, we talked about it. We talked about it imperfectly as a sangha, but we talked about it. It was something that we discussed, that was brought up, that we were able to sort of work out. Same thing, with the genocide in Palestine. These topics, we don't shy away from. They come up during the community discussion, and I think avoiding them will ostracize certain people. So I think just like being open to, yeah, how people are feeling, what they're feeling, in that moment, the challenges that they're going through, you know, being open to the emotions that are involved with that, the tears, you know, the being able to, you know, just like hold the really challenging stuff that gets shared. And then we also for a long time had these sort of community agreements before we had discussions where we talked about, you know, like what is said in the room stays in the room, speaking from the eye. I think they were based off of East Bay Meditation Center's community agreements. So we would read those, which was really helpful. I think just, yeah, not assuming anything about who, how someone identifies or who they're romantically involved with, being open to welcoming, yeah, all kinds of people and having, you know, having places that are wheelchair accessible is also really important for folks to show up, to even just come through the door.
And speaking of accessibility, are there any adaptations that you folks have made in terms of accommodating neurodiverse folks?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, we do have a lot of neurodiversity in the Sangha. So it might have happened naturally without us even realizing that that's why we were making those accommodations. We very much welcome during the opening round, the intro round, people are welcome to pass, and people do pass all the time. And there's no question, there's no, you know, encouragement to share or anything like that. We just go to the next person. I think the fact that we are hybrid does allow for that accessibility. We have a lot of people who come from Montreal online, and you know, for whatever reason, they don't want to leave their house or they can't leave their house sometimes. And you know, that's great to be able to still have them in the space with us, to still be connected to the Sangha from afar. We always try to read the chat out, so to keep the people linked in with the, and then we've gone through many microphone changes over the years, but we currently have, I think they're called lavalier mics, that we're able to pass around. We try to make it so that if there's someone talking in the room, that they're able to have a mic instead of them having to come all the way up to the computer. Because what ends up happening is like people will have discussions or say things away from the computer, and then they can't hear, the people online can't hear. So there's a fair bit of mic running that happens. It's a necessary fact of running the sanghas, of having all the voices heard, is bringing the microphone around.
Yeah, and those are really important things. And so, was there anything else that you'd like to share before we close?
No, I mean, I think just thank you for this opportunity to talk about queer sangha and to talk about myself. I don't get to do it that often. So it's fun to, yeah, it's just fun to think about it.
Well, thank you so much for coming. Queer Sangha is such an important service, and I'm so glad that we got to have somebody representing Queer Sangha to talk to the podcast, and that we got to learn a bit about your journey as well. And thank you to our listeners for listening to this podcast, and stay tuned for more episodes.